The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Webb, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ken Webb. I represent John and Sandy Moore in an action pending in the United States District Court for the Northern District of West Virginia against Equitrans for breach of contract and trespass related to the placement and replacement of a high-pressure natural gas transmission pipeline designated H557. In 2015, we had a jury trial on the issue of trespass and breach of contract damages and actually obtained a verdict from a jury concluding that sections of the pipeline were trespassing across the Moore's property. A section that was initially laid in the 1950s or 60s was laid inappropriately on the Moore's and off an adjoiner's property. And a section of pipeline that was replaced because it had corroded and pitted sections in 1996-97 timeframe was also relocated off of the right-of-way and placed in another area on the Moore's property. The jury in 2015 heard all of this evidence and concluded that Equitrans pipeline was trespassing in those two distinct locations. According to the trial witnesses, H557 is a 16-inch high-pressure natural gas pipeline. Part of the trespassing pipeline was laid off of the right-of-way during initial construction. Part was laid off of the right-of-way during replacement or refurbishment.
So this case is really a case about damages.
It has become that,
It has become that. Partly because of the way in which the trial process began. Tell me, what sort of strategy led you to pursue that just in the matter that you did initially, where you didn't seek any instructions on intentional trespass, and there was nothing at trial that emphasized intent or bad faith? So what was the strategy in doing that?
Initially, Your Honor, the strategy was to seek an ejectment of the pipeline and to avoid all of the onerous damages issues that we're into right now. And so in my judgment, early in the case, it would be easier to resolve the case by getting an order requiring that the pipeline be ejected and moved. I thought that would present an opportunity for the Moores and Equitrans to negotiate a new right-of-way on the two areas where the pipeline was trespassing. You are correct, Your Honor, because we weren't focused on damages then, we didn't have a special interrogatory that we put to the jury.
So tell me, how does that work? Could you have gone for, could you have brought that matter to the court at the time on intentional trespass and sought damages along with an alternate remedy of perhaps of ejectment or in?
Yeah, at the time, Your Honor, there was confusion about whether those two things, damages and ejectment, were mutually exclusive or whether or not you had to elect one or the other. There was quite a bit of urging on the part of Equitrans that we had to elect a remedy. I think they were pushing us towards damages, I think because they knew the law of damages at the time better than I did.
So what would that mean practically in trying cases? You trial a number of cases. Are you saying that in these cases you get two trials? You get to do, you elect one, and if you don't win on that one, or if you don't get what you want, you then can come back and ask for a different result, or then move for damages in a different theory?
You don't get two trials, typically, Your Honor. I understand that as a trial attorney. In this case, there wasn't a waiver. There wasn't an intelligent election about damages versus ejectment. The district court in several orders inconsistently ruled about whether ejectment was an appropriate remedy versus whether damages was an appropriate remedy. So while we were working the case up, the district court said, I think ejectment is an appropriate remedy. Had the district court said at that time, Mr. Webb, I'm not going to let you eject the pipeline, we'd have moved on to damages. We'd have developed the damages case. It only became an issue. Ejectment only became an issue after we obtained a verdict for trespass and sent a judgment order to the court requiring ejectment. At that time, Equitrans argued, and the court adopted the argument, and this was their argument: you're not entitled to ejectment because monetary damages may be an appropriate remedy. And the court agreed and said it hadn't determined whether monetary damages was an appropriate remedy, not going to let you eject the pipeline. In the meantime,
what's the effect of Equitrans consistently saying, well, you know, you do this, we're gonna seek condemnation? What do you think the effect of that is in terms of seeking a remedy of ejectment?
I think they should have filed a compulsory counterclaim in the alternative for condemnation throughout the defense of the case.
But they didn't have to, is what I'm saying. You could pursue it, and yet they could still go for condemnation, and they told you they were going to do that.
Throughout the case, they argued.
And so what do you think is going to happen if you pursue ejectment and then they go for condemnation?
Throughout the case, they argued they weren't trespassing, and they refused to concede they were trespassing so that they could condemn. Honestly, and this was the subject of our first appeal, I didn't think Equitrans had the power to use the Natural Gas Act to condemn because they already had a right-of-way. And so I didn't think they had any power to condemn. But those were issues that were yet to be determined and tried and litigated. Under the circumstances of the damages versus ejectment issue, I don't think there was an effective, intelligent, knowing waiver. The district court never said, we're not going to let you pursue ejectment. If that had been said, clearly we'd moved on to damages. We'd have developed that case. And so that's the first assignment of error is, okay, under the circumstances.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? So I think I understand your argument that there was no waiver. So the district court, just in the order we're actually reviewing now, the district court relied on waiver as to contract damages, but not as to trespass damages, right?
So
the whole waiver issue is relevant only as to contract damages.
That's my understanding.
Okay, so, and again, you tell me if I'm misreading the record. It's complicated, and you obviously know the case better than I do. But it seemed like when Equitrans moved to exclude evidence of contract damages, it wasn't based on waiver. The motion was just a basic evidentiary motion. Look, no actual evidence of contract damages has been identified in discovery. I understand the district court seems to have ruled kind of sua sponte on waiver grounds instead. But why is Equitrans not right that, waived or not, there's nothing in discovery to suggest that there was an actual harm from the fact that the pipeline was a few feet over in the pasture from where it was supposed to be? I understand why there might be trespass damages from that, but where are the compensatory contract damages from that? And where's the evidence of it in discovery?
Right. There is some evidence from Mr. Howe, who testified about the system downtime savings, which may be a breach of contract damages. You may be able to recover under a breach of contract theory the costs avoided by the breach. And we've cited a Northern District case on to that effect. And that's the best we have on the breach of contract.
Okay. Okay, so there is no evidence in the record from discovery of any sort of any harm to the plaintiffs. Okay.
Yes. Ultimately, the case.
So tell me about this Mr. Howell that you rely upon for information and what his level of expertise, because I don't recall seeing any basic principles or assumptions pertaining to the downtown remedy during the deposition.
We believe, Judge, that the proper measure of damages is the reasonable rental value of the unauthorized use, and not.
I understand what you believe. I'm focusing on Mr. Howell because his testimony seems to be a bit problematic to me. I'm not sure he's what he holds himself out to be, and some of his testimony really is very concerning in terms of the level of the opinion that he renders here, unsupported. But you just mentioned him there, and I just want you to sort of give some basis as to why you think his testimony is something that should influence the outcome here.
He is the principal of Pipeline Equity. He has years of experience in evaluating, valuing, appraising pipeline systems for natural gas and other products. He also has experience negotiating on behalf of landowners pipeline right-of-ways in instances where the party seeking the right-of-way doesn't have condemnation power. So it's an arm's length transaction. And so he's well-versed at putting a value on a right-of-way. And that's what we're using. That's what we're hoping to use his testimony for, to determine what a reasonable rental value is for the use, the trespassing use of the property. He looked at, and he had this information from Equitrans, the overall length of the pipeline H557, the little bit that was trespassing, the proceeds, the revenues that Equitrans derived from its tariff rate for charging people to move gas on the pipeline, and he looked at the period of trespass. He was able
Who was it that wrote most of his report? It looks like somebody else wrote some.
He has an associate that he works with who did some of the research to get some of the tariff rates, and he did write some of the report. But Mr. Howe was the testifying expert who testified about the ultimate opinions rendered in the report. He relied upon the information gathered by his associate. If I could just get back on to the argument, the district court goes to great pains to reinterpret the jury verdict by saying that in the district court's opinion, there was no trespass, that the right-of-way agreement can be read in a different way so as to have a 50-foot width, so that placing a replaced or a renewed pipeline anywhere in that width was not a trespass.
Counsel, it's Judge Harris. Can I just, I hate to interrupt you, but this seems like another case where that was not the basis for Equitrans' motion, right? This was, again, the district court kind of sua sponte coming up with this 25-foot theory. But what Equitrans said was, look, we already had a liability trial. Like, it's too late now at the damages phase to start talking about intentional trespass and bad faith trespass for the first time. So the motion was based more on sort of, I guess, a waiver theory, which the district court did seem to adopt in its first order, although I grant you in this latest order, instead, it came up with this new theory about the buffer zones. But why isn't Equitrans right, again, in what it said in its actual motion, which is just it's too late now to start talking about bad faith trespass?
The evidence, the allegations in the original complaint certainly allege deliberate intentional trespass. The evidence at trial, Henry Reveille Allen, some of the internal memoranda from Equitrans indicates that the line was moved off of the right of way for business reasons and against the interests of the plaintiff.
So I may have misunderstood. I thought in your original colloquy with Judge Wynn, you were more or less conceding, look, at trial, we didn't do this because we thought we were going to get ejectment and we weren't worried about damages at that point. You're saying actually at trial, you did try the issue of bad faith trespass.
We did.
And where did that arise for you to be able to do that? Where did you state in your complaint anything about bad faith or willfulness?
It's we've cited this in our brief, but in several places with respect to the trespass allegation, it's alleged to be intentional, deliberate.
In your complaint, what is the language there? I don't recall seeing anything in your complaint to that effect.
Yeah, just using those words in the paragraphs describing the trespass, intentional, deliberate. The evidence at trial supported that as well.
Mr. Webb, basically, your theory was that it was bad faith because they knew they were in the wrong place?
Yes.
Is that the extent of it?
They didn't want to have to go back to the moors to acquire an easement, and so they just moved the pipeline off of the right-of-way without telling the moors. And then also at trial, the moors testified that when they questioned Equitrans about the location of the replaced line, they were always told it's on the right of way. And so they were misled to some extent. This is a hilltop in West Virginia. You wouldn't have a reason to go up there and observe the construction. It's a ridgetop. It's at the top of a field.
Counsel, just so your position is that you state a claim for bad faith trespass under West Virginia law, so long as the trespasser knows it's not his land. I thought more was required than that. I thought it required more than you actually know you're not supposed to be there. I thought you had to do it with an intent to take an unconscientious advantage of your victim. That's not, you think it's enough, just if you know it's not your land.
I think they did take an unconscientious advantage of them, or worse, by relocating the pipeline, not telling them, and not seeking a new right of way.
I understand that you think so, but did you allege that in your complaint?
We allege deliberate and intentional trespass. We didn't allege those facts specifically. Okay. I've got three other assignments of error that I want to touch on briefly, if I may. I see that my time has expired.
Well, it has to be briefly unless you're going to eat into your rebuttal. Go ahead.
Okay, just briefly. We also think the district court erred by concluding that without House testimony, there was no evidence of damages that the court was not aware of, other evidence in the record, because no motion for summary judgment was pending. We have evidence from Equitrans witnesses who we deposed and got documents from about what they pay to acquire right of way when they can't condemn it, and about what they pay to rent pipeline facilities. And that is in the record, and that is evidence of damages. We also have evidence of a cell tower lease on the adjoining ridge that has some surface value, which would be a measure of damages. Again, we think the proper measure of damages is the reasonable rental value of the unauthorized use, not the value of the naked parcel, which gives a tortfeasor private right of inverse condemnation, which we think is unjust and not the law in West Virginia. For all of those reasons, we would ask that the district court's order be reversed and that the matter be remanded so that the Moores can get a trial on damages. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Mr. Hendrickson, you're on mute.
Yeah, sorry, Your Honor. I'm not very good at this Zoom stuff. I apologize. Please the court. My name is Dave Hendrickson. I represent Equitrans in this appeal. As you've heard, this case started over a FERC-regulated pipeline that was repaired. And when it was repaired, two pieces of the new section were placed to the side of the old pipeline outside the existing right-of-way. Equitrans predecessors had a right-of-way to enter the land and operate and maintain this pipeline. The right-of-way has existed since the 1960s and runs through a steep hillside land that has always been used for a pasture. The Moores sued Equitrans for breach of the right-of-way agreement and trespass in her complaint in 2012. When the case was tried in 2015, plaintiffs only tendered witnesses on the counts of trespass and the breach of the right-of-way agreement. They offered no evidence on damages and only sought the remedy of objection. The jury found two sections totaling 624 feet of the pipeline were placed outside the existing right-of-way. After the verdict, Equitrans initiated an action to condemn the property. During this process, the circuit court stayed the current action. A trial was held to set just compensation for the condemned property, and a jury returned a verdict for $5,000, although our expert testified that it was worth $800.
I suppose you waited until after the trial to seek condemnation. What was the reason for that?
Because we didn't think that we could proceed with condemnation at that point in time, Your Honor, because we believed that we were still in the right-of-way. And so until we found out by a jury verdict or otherwise that we weren't out inside the right-of-way, which we still believe we were inside the right-of-way even after the verdict, we didn't think we had a basis for condemnation. But we did make it very clear, Your Honor, through the entire process that if the jury were to rule that we were trespassing, that we would seek condemnation. That was never an issue. That was clear almost a year before trial.
So let me understand. You have a right of way, and the allegation is that you're 15 feet off of it, and you're saying that's okay, that you were given that opportunity. You could go 15 feet off. Is that your contention?
Your Honor, when you look at the deed wasn't very artfully drawn. I mean, it was drawn back in the 60s, and I'm not condemning the lawyers from back then because there were a lot of good lawyers back in the 60s, but today they're a little more tight. The deed actually says that there's a 25-foot section on each side of the pipe that you can't build on. So we thought we had access to put the pipeline next to the old pipeline as opposed to just tearing the old one out, stopping it, putting the new one in.
That was primarily an economic decision to some extent, wasn't it? I mean, you were able to use the old one.
Sure.
While you put that one in. I just want to know out of a matter of curiosity, if you have an easement and the easement conveys what you purely say, at least some ambiguity as to whether you can do it, how is that resolved, in favor of the person holding the easement or of the person who gave it? I mean, what's the presumption?
Presumption would probably be in favor of the person that gave the easement. I would assume, Your Honor.
That's what I would think.
Yeah, that's right.
If that's so, and then you have reasonable interpretation both ways, and they're 15 feet off, why wouldn't it be presumed you are trespassing because this deed doesn't clearly convey to you that you can do this?
Well, first of all, we weren't 15 feet off on every section. We were 15 feet off in some places, okay? We didn't know at the time that we were off 15 feet. Second of all, you just answered your own question. We couldn't presume, we had to know. And we felt, and that's why we tried the case, we felt that the pipeline was within sight of the right-of-way that still existed at the time. Jury found otherwise. And once they did, we moved to condemn the property.
So you equated the prohibited area to the owner as part of your ability to put the pipeline in? Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
That's pretty far from what law of realty and servitudes on property, isn't it?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, when you look at a lot of these oil and gas pipeline right-of-ways that are granted, there's always a setback on both sides. And the reason for that is a couple of things. One is to get in there and maintain the pipe so you can maneuver around. And number two is if you ever have to move the pipe a little bit, for whatever reason, you got room to do that. And so I don't think it's contrary to existing law at all.
Well, did you give the owner notice that you were taking that broader interpretation?
Well, the first section of pipeline, Your Honor, that was actually found to be outside the right-of-way was done back in the original pipeline. So I don't know what happened back in the 60s when that pipeline was put in. The second piece, and then again, picture a very rural section of West Virginia way up on the mountain. I don't think they did. I think they went in and repaired it because they had the right to go in and do it, and that's what they did. Did they actually say to them, hey, we're moving it from here to there? I don't think so.
So do you think that's a
counsel? Go ahead, Judge.
No, Judge Harris.
You go.
Just to finish up on that thought, if I could, please, Judge. During the trial, Mr. Moore said he did know about the replacement. Mrs. Moore said she didn't, because there was an issue that came up about statute of limitations and prospective easement. Mr. Moore said he did know about it. She said she didn't. And under the law of West Virginia, both parties, husband and wife, have to know before the jury can rule in favor of statute of limitations. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
It's Judge Harris.
Thank you, Chief Judge Gregory. This issue about whether there was, in fact, a trespass given the 25-foot buffer zones, which is probably not the term of art, in the order we're actually reviewing, it appears that the district court effectively adopts that position. Which would mean, I think, that the jury was wrong at trial. So what do you want us to make of the part in the current order where, well after the jury appears to have rejected this theory, that it pops up again because the district court says, well, there can't have been any bad faith trespass here because you were entitled to move the pipe anywhere within that 25-foot easement?
The judge on remand is allowed to look at the total record as it stands. He looked at the total record, for example. The remand said what they wanted the judge to do was to clarify the earlier order. And remember now, this Judge Bailey clarifying an order by Judge Stamp, who retired. And so what Judge Bailey's allowed to do is go back and look at the entire record to see what's in that record. These folks were trying to once again move to amend their complaint to add willful trespass. I find it ironic that they said they pled it in the earlier complaint, which they didn't. And then twice afterwards, they try to amend their complaint to add it. So what Judge Bailey was looking at when he looked at that section wasn't to say the jury was wrong. What he was saying was, I see why they thought they had the right to do that. It was an innocent trespass. In other words, it's a trespass, but it's an innocent trespass. Doesn't mean the jury
tell me
was
about
wrong.
This. Tell me about this innocent trespass. You say you got up to 25 feet on each side, and you can put that pipe somewhere, I guess, within 25 feet on each side, which when you add it together, that's 50 feet across. You put it over 15 feet. What happens then? Have you moved over that 25 feet another 15 feet? So now it's 40 feet from the original center line and on one side and then the other? I mean, it looks like to me you keep doing that. You could actually put that pipe at right at 24, 25 feet and then expand another 25 feet into the property.
You're right.
How does that work? That doesn't seem to follow to me at all. It's one thing to have the buffer of 25 feet, which simply says you can't use property or you can't do anything on this or you know, you can't dig and do things like that. It's another thing to come in the purpose of your easement, which is right down the center, says 25 feet from that center, and you move it 15 or more. And then if you read that deed, then 10 years later, you're going to say, well, we got 25 more feet we can move it over. And then you keep doing it. So how does that follow? That doesn't seem to follow to me at all. I got the 25 feet, but I don't see how you reasonably believe you could put a pipe 15 feet from the center line if you think you've got 25 feet on each other on the original deed, unless you think that 25 feet just remains constant. But the deed doesn't read that way.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, on the first section that they found there was a trespass, again, that pipeline was placed, I guess, off the easement from the very beginning. So I don't know what happened there.
Let's just deal with where we are now. I know you've got some variations of whether it was 25 or 15 feet or off the center. I'm just dealing with just the general statement that you believe that even if you placed it 15 feet from the center line, it was within your a right to do so, and it wasn't a trespass. Given the consideration that on doing so, you necessarily now have moved that 25-foot line over another 15 feet.
Well, Your Honor, when you
at least on one side.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Go ahead.
At least on one side. But go ahead. Right.
No, what I was going to say, when you look at the way this deed was written, it was in meets and bounds. And so it wasn't as exact as some of the deeds are today. And so to say that it was exactly 15 feet or 3 feet or 2 feet is really hard to say. And so all I'm saying is when Judge Bailey took a look at this in order to make his decision as to whether or not it was an innocent trespass versus a willful or intentional, et cetera, type, then he looked at that and said, look, you know, you had 25 feet on both sides there. And clearly they thought they had the right to do that. And so that's what was tried in front of the jury. The jury said, no, you didn't. And the jury said that we were wrong. And so they
Counsel, can I just interrupt? So the district court, as you've described it, does make that judgment. But in your motion to exclude evidence of intentional or bad faith trespass, that's not the ground you relied on. You just said this is waived. Like they had to raise this. If they wanted to litigate this, they needed to litigate it at the liability phase. It's too late to do it for the first time at this damages phase. So I guess I understand why you're defending the district court's reasoning on this, but you don't need it to prevail, right? It wasn't even your argument before the district court.
Judge, no, we don't. The reason
I understand.
The one judge brought it up.
I just wanted to make sure I understood. This is not an argument you made to the district court.
No, in 2012, they filed their complaint. 2015, we litigated the case to verdict. They didn't offer any jury instructions on intentional trespass, willful trespass, anything. And the only damage they sought was ejectment. And so we tried that case, and the jury came back with a verdict. After the case was tried, we went ahead and filed the motion for condemnation, and we won that. That came up on appeal to this court. This court affirmed the condemnation case, and we went forward. And so after that, when we went back, Judge Stamp said, I want to have a status memorandum from both sides. And we did that. And when we submitted our status memorandum, the plaintiffs wanted to amend their complaint to add willful trespass. Judge Stamp said no. And he dismissed their case saying that it was futile. They couldn't prove any damages. And so
let me ask you a follow-up question. If you just assume hypothetically for a minute that I agree that it was too late in the day to raise intentional and bad faith trespass, and also just assume for a moment that I agree with you that the Howell report has to be stricken because the damages calculation is inconsistent with West Virginia law. That, doesn't that still leave a question as to whether there is some evidence of a property value-based damages for trespass in this case, that the district court just sort of jumped ahead and sua sponte said, never mind, we're all done here. I'm issuing judgment sua sponte. I'm concerned about that last piece of it, the plaintiffs here were never on notice from this motions in limine practice that they needed to prove up right now, demonstrate their evidence of a proper damages calculation for trespass.
Well, first of all, if I could go back, when Judge Bailey issued his order that we're going to have a trial on damages for breach of contract and trespass, we obviously didn't agree with that. Because your court asked the judge to clarify the earlier order. And so we thought he stepped outside the bounds in doing that. But we went ahead and said, okay. They didn't put on any evidence of the damages that you're talking about right now. And the reason they didn't.
But with respect to contract damages, you said exclude all damages, all contract damages, any evidence of contract damages, because they haven't shown any in discovery. But there was no comparable motion over on the trespass side. So I don't see how they were on notice on trespass as they were on contracts that, look, if you've got anything on damages, bring it forward now.
The judge told them that in this order. And second of all, because the judge excluded Mr. Howell, who, if you read his transcript, it would be a fascinating reading for you, Your Honor. But when they excluded Mr. Howell, they had nothing left. They didn't put forth any damage issue that the judge could hold his hat on. There's nothing left there. They say they did.
They say there is evidence in the discovery. After discovery, there's evidence in the record, you know, comparable plots being rented for certain amounts, that there's even, an Equitrans witness who said, okay, maybe $700, that there's something in the record. And now we're left to review it. I mean, there's no summary judgment record for us to review because this was all done sua sponte. No one moved for a judgment. The motions in limine did not say exclude all evidence. I just feel like there's a last step here that the district court didn't do. There was no actual summary judgment record on this issue.
Your Honor, if you go back and you look at what the judge was asked to do, he's asked to clarify the order why Judge Stamp had ruled that their damages was to prove damage was futile. He went one step further and said, okay, we're going to give you an opportunity now to put forth your damages on trespass, according to law in West Virginia, and on contracts, breach of contract. They put on no evidence on breach of contract. So that's out. On the trespass part, they didn't put on any evidence there either. Because what they tried to do was hit a home run by bringing in Mr. Howe to put a value on the pipeline and the oil and gas that went through it, which is totally contrary to West Virginia law, to the tune of $2.2 million. And so when the judge dismissed Mr. Howe's stuff, what they were left was they said, oh, well, by the way, there's a cell tower up here that's being rented that they get X number of dollars a year for. Well, that's not comparable to what the property is here, and that's outside the law in West Virginia. The other piece of evidence they want to point to says, well, Equitrans in the past, in other areas, has paid X dollars for a right-of-way. Again, it's not comparable. You're not comparing.
Well, maybe or maybe not, but what I am missing is a district court ruling on that point. Like, that just seems like a lot for us to decide, given that there was no motion for summary judgment. We're missing the part of the record where the parties would be expected to list out the undisputed facts. Like, none of that happened here on these issues that you're talking about, because the district court sua sponte decided to jump ahead on summary judgment. You're not supposed to do that unless people are on notice.
The judge has the power to do that, especially after.
Yeah, but he is bound by the rules of civil procedure. That's what Judge Harris is going here on this. You got a motion in limine. You got to give notice to the other party, and you got to give an opportunity to be heard here. And what happens, I mean, all well and good of what you're saying, but the court can't just take it over and allow an amendment for damages or whatever the complaint, and then all of a sudden convert a motion in limine without any opportunity in the record of the other party being heard or notice or anything, and says summary judgment. I just don't understand how we get to that point. As Judge Harris has pointed out, you know, in under the rules of civil procedure. That doesn't seem right. I mean, at least procedurally, you should at least allow for notice and allow an opportunity to be heard. Where is that provided here?
Your Honor,
is that provided? Let me ask that. Was that provided, in your view, here to this to the?
Yes.
Tell me how
so. First of all, again, I go back to the fact that this court told the judge to clarify why he had granted the motion earlier to dismiss the case. Judge Bailey took it a step further. Oh, I thought I lost you there. Sorry, my screen went blank. Judge Bailey took it a step further and said, I'm going to give you another bite at the apple. I'm going to let you prove any damages you have for breach of contract that were pled in 2012 and for trespass that were pled in 2012 and tried in 2015. He gave them that opportunity.
So he allowed them to amend, and once that did, it changed the nature of what you were dealing with and then the rules of civil procedure. Once you get the amendment in, it's not exactly what we sent back. It's different, isn't it?
Well, he didn't allow it to amend. What he did was he said, okay, I'm going to
Did you say he did or did not allow them to amend?
He didn't allow them to amend their complaint. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. He did not allow them to do that. What I meant was that he went back and said, okay, I'm going to once again give you a second bite of the apple and let you attempt to prove damages, even though they elected the ejectment remedy before. And if you look back on the record, they put no evidence in at the first trial of damages at all. And the reason for that is very simple, Your Honor. When you really look at it and boil it down, you know why they didn't put any evidence into damages? Because they weren't damaged. That's why. And what this is it was an attempt to hold a pipeline company hostage by trying to build up damages that aren't permissible and allowable under West Virginia law.
So when you say it didn't allow them men, fair, that's fair enough. But he did read that complaint to say they had pled the damages, and then he also referred to them in the process of doing that. So I mean, why does that not change the game, so to speak, once he does that? He says they haven't waived it.
Sorry, Your Honor, I apologize.
He said they didn't waive it, and so why does it not change the game? The whole point here is there seems to be a procedural step, not a question of whether who wins or does not win, but to go in on a motion in limine and end up with a sua sponte summary judgment on a matter in which you say there's notice, but I don't know where the notice is coming from once you've got this, the judge makes this ruling that okay, your complaint does plead this, you haven't waived it. And then you proceed to then move forward. You don't know this until the judge actually rules on it. Then that, I mean, what is the notice you got that now I'm going to go ahead and proceed with summary judgment?
Judge, when you're a trial lawyer, the judge sets the parameters for what you're supposed to be trying, correct? And that's what he did here.
He is bound by the parameters of the rules of civil procedure, whether you're a trial lawyer, a judge, or appellate judge, it's the law. And
correct.
So, you know, when you're dealing with it, my point is not going in terms of the nuances of trial. I realize trials can change up and you have different ways to go. But the basic principle of notice and opportunity to be heard is embedded in the rules. And you know that. So that's what I'm asking you to address. Why, once the judge makes this determination that, OK, you pled damages, you didn't waive them, then you're moving to summary judgment. Where's the notice and opportunity to be heard?
The notice and opportunity was there, Your Honor, because he was there on notice of the fact that he wanted them to come forward. It's not our obligation to come forward with the proof. It's their obligation to come forward with the proof. And when he looked at the record as a whole, after evaluating our motions in limine, there's absolutely no proof in the record of damages on contract, breach of contract, i.e. breach of the right-of-way, or on common law trespass damages in West Virginia. And that's why he ruled the way he did. And so to file motion for summary judgment.
Counsel, sorry. Judge Harris, I think I don't want to repeat myself, but let me try just one more time on this notice question. As to contracts, I think I understand what you're saying. Your motion in limine did say exclude all evidence of contract damages because there's nothing like that in the record. And I can at least see an argument that would be sufficient to put the plaintiffs on notice. If you've got contract damages, come forward now. But you did not file a similar motion over on the trespass side. There wasn't anything saying, look, There's no evidence in this record of any trespass damages at all. You did say no damages for bad faith and this Howell thing, $2.2 million, that's out. But you didn't take the final step. You didn't file a motion that said, and given that, there's nothing in this record on any kind of trespass damage. So I guess maybe my question is, why not? If you think it was so clear, why didn't you file the same kind of motion you filed on the contract side on the trespass side? That maybe would have put people on notice, but you didn't do that.
Your Honor, they had relied so heavily on Mr. Howell. Mr. Howell was their witness that was going to come forward and prove their damages. We took his deposition over a two-day period and filed a pretty extensive motion limiting to exclude Mr. Howell. And when Mr. Howell was excluded, we thought that was the end of the damages. We didn't think we needed to file another motion limiting to say any other trespass damages, because there wasn't anything left. And that's why the judge ruled the way he ruled.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I apologize for running over. I was just trying to answer the question.
No, you were answering questions. No need to apologize. Mr. Webb?
Briefly, we didn't get any notice about a summary judgment motion that attempted to argue that there was no evidence in the record on any trespass.
You just heard the answer that Mr. Hendrickson gave to Judge Harris regarding why they didn't bring a separate motion to deal with the damages of trespass. He said because you had relied so heavily on Mr. Howell, and when he was excluded, you just didn't have any evidence there.
Certainly, Your Honor. Mr. Howell was one component of the trespass damages, but we also developed testimony from the witnesses for Equitrans, who we deposed, Baxter, Friend, and Quinn, about what they pay, what Equitrans pays to acquire rights of way, or what they pay to rent the use of pipeline facilities. And those are measures of damages. Those are measures of the reasonable rental value to transport gas across a facility that you don't own. In the case of the Sunrise Pipeline and the Allegheny Valley Connector Pipeline, Equitrans pays $5.18 per foot per month to transport gas across those pipelines. And so that's evidence of what would you pay, or what would be the reasonable rental value of using 700 feet of the Moore's property. That's an easy calculation to make. And so that evidence is in the record. I don't think the district court judge knew about that evidence because that wasn't the subject of a motion in limine. Had we been presented with a motion for summary judgment, asserting or alleging or arguing that there was no evidence of damages beyond how, we could have pointed to that evidence in the record in response and say, no, that's incorrect. Here's the evidence. And so also we had the evidence of the cell tower value. I just don't think the district court judge knew about the evidence because it wasn't the subject of a motion in limine, and nobody filed a motion for summary judgment. So we didn't have an opportunity to marshal our facts in opposition to a motion for summary judgment to show, no, there is a material dispute about the fact of damages, and here's the evidence that we can marshal that supports our allegation that we've been damaged on the trespass claim. And so
Can I just ask you a factual question, something from the record that I didn't fully understand? So in talking about this, the district court says that that your clients have said they don't want to testify. They're not going to testify about their own subjective valuation of the land, which would be admissible under West Virginia law, but they said they're not going to do that. I just couldn't find, there's no record site and I couldn't find it. Can you tell me where that is in the record?
It may be in John Moore's deposition transcript.
Okay.
I would concede that the Moores, Mr. Moore's a farmer and Mrs. Moore works as a secretary at an elementary school. They don't have any idea what the reasonable rental value is of trespassing high pressure natural gas distribution pipeline. Mr. Moore can testify about what he paid for the farm, or what his dad paid for the farm, or what an acre of farm pasture land's worth, but we don't think that's the appropriate measure. This is a subterranean trespass. And so we don't think that the Moores are qualified to give an opinion about the value of the unauthorized use of the property. We think we get that evidence in through how, and we get it in through Equitrans witnesses who are in that business and who purchase right away or rent right away when they don't otherwise own it. And we think that's the best evidence, the most reliable, the most applicable evidence of what a reasonable rental value is for Equitrans unauthorized use of the Morse property for 25 years. It's a substantial.
Do I understand you to say that the Moores couldn't testify as to how they believe their land was damaged?
They can't. They can testify about the fact that there was a trespass, that the line was there improperly, but they can't testify about the reasonable rental value of the unauthorized use. But they can't testify about the fact of a trespass.
May I ask you, Mr. Webb, how did you conclude or at least have a theory that your damages for trespass in large part would be how much money they were making in the transportation of natural gas through their right of way on that pipeline? How did you conclude that?
Just trying to figure out what a reasonable rental value of the use is. I think the best evidence of that is.
And you're in common law torts and you're trying to restore or figure out what your damage is. How did you conclude that your damages constituted their profits?
We're not asking for a disgorgement of profits. We're only asking for a reasonable rental value of the use. If this were a disgorgement of profits case, Your Honor, the amount of damages would be astronomical. The 25-year use of this pipeline to transport gas, it produces billions of dollars of revenue. We've only asked for a very small, slim slice of that based upon the use of 700 feet of a trespassing pipeline that's 17 miles long. We've taken into consideration the operations of the pipeline over the 25-year period. And so it really is just a use-based rental calculation and not a disgorgement of profits or a disgorgement of all benefits.
So your theory, not theory, but the evidence you said that was left over, and the questions that Judge Harris and Judge Wynn raised are apt, but I think correct in terms of there was no summary judgment motion. It was just a motion eliminated, then sua sponte. And when you got there, did you do anything other than just appealing the case to us?
Yeah, we just decided to appeal. We were blindsided by the.
What about a motion for reconsideration of a sua sponte dismissal?
You didn't do that. Yeah, we did not. We did not.
Okay, but you would agree it was sort of awkward when you do that. I'm sure you were surprised, weren't you, when you got that?
We were.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all I have. Judge Harris, Judge Wynn, any further questions?
No further questions.
All right.
No, well, thank you.
Well, thank you both very much for your argument. We can't come down and greet you like we would in our normal tradition of the Fourth Circuit, but nonetheless, we very much appreciate your being here and appreciate your helping us on this case. And wish you well and be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you now. Take care.